TNT Radio wants you to get on our soapbox because your opinion matters. Tell us what you really think at tntradio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. Speaking on the issues that impact. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, welcome. We're into the second hour now. Thank you for rejoining us. What an incredible conversation with veteran journalist Finian Cunningham. And, you know, Finian is he's been in the game for a while. He's very experienced. He's a prolific writer, and he really has spent time on the ground in a lot of these regions and knows the geopolitics really well in Africa, in the Middle East, in Europe, and other places in the world. So I can't think of a better person to bring on board. And we really appreciate some of these analysts that we're able to have some sort of a conference with on these important subjects. We'll continue to do this, by the way. In fact, we're gonna make a point to do this every week. We will be focusing on geopolitics every week, along with the other areas of focus that we've added to our new format here on the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT, 5 days a week, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m. UK time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and all the rest of the time zones. This is a global network. Now, we're going to be joined by French international lawyer Arnaud Davalet in just a few minutes. Before that, this you probably heard over the headline break, and I commented on this with the top of the hour news headlines with TNT. Army unit turned strategy for adversaries against own citizens. Ladies and gentlemen, nothing new here. The only thing new is that the mainstream media is finally sort of reporting on it the way they should, but it was only because of a FOIA request and because of some work done by various groups to find out this information here. A British Army unit, notoriously known as the 77th Brigade, okay? It's a boiler room. It's a troll factory. It's run by the British military. They can call it whatever they want, dress it up, call it whatever they want, put lipstick all over that pig, okay? But they were caught using the sort of surveillance that they would use against their so-called foreign adversaries and deploying it domestically on British politicians, journalists, who dared to criticize the nation's response to COVID-19. And I would probably add they're doing that to activists as well. So according to the report in the UK's Daily Mail, once in a while, the Mail are good for some journalism. Here's one good example. So, you know, props where props are due. There's a lot of garbage and trash on the Mail, but once in a while, they do some journalism. Okay, thanks, guys. Much appreciated. Please do more. 77th Brigade, which the Mail said had a mission of using, quote, non-lethal engagement and legitimate non-military levers as a means to adapt to behaviors of adversaries, social engineering, propaganda, nudging. So this is the military's nudge unit. Little bit of a blunt instrument, to say the least. Okay, I'm not going to comment on the quality of the 77th Brigade trolls on Twitter, but many users have already learned how to spot them. And if only the 77th Brigade knew how easy it was to spot their own trolls, they probably wouldn't be doing what they're doing. But who knows? As they say, you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. Not the highest quality trolls, but nonetheless, they do what they do. So this is interesting. And who are they spying on? British politician David Davis. David Davis, former higher-ranking minister. And David Davis, this is a Tory MP, you know, very libertarian in his orientation. It's interesting the military was going after this MP. I can't believe we're even having this conversation, but of course it shouldn't surprise anybody. So he was among the targets. And quote, he's saying here, he told the Mail, commented on this. He said, it's outrageous that people questioning the government's policies were subject to covert surveillance. Oh, really? It is outrageous, but it's not new, David Davis. But yeah, Amazing. So this military unit, this troll factory, this boiler room of computer jockeys, joined the lofty titled Counter Disinformation Unit. Are we in the Soviet Union or something here? Is the irony lost even on these people? Do these people understand? If they were intelligent and had some historical perspective, they would realize that they're recreating Stalin's Soviet Russia just with some new expensive toys, guys, or the East German Stasi, okay? And so this counter disinformation unit is based inside the Department of Digital Culture, Media, and Sport. Oh, that's interesting. What an interesting place to have it. Why don't you just have a Ministry of Truth or a Ministry of Counter Propaganda? Just even a halfway misleading title would be fine. And also the Rapid Response Unit in the Cabinet Office. Oh, now we're getting somewhere. And their remit was to go beyond surveillance and counter what they called, quote, disinformation. Now, the Western governments, namely the UK and the United States, like to use this new invented term, which they invented after the election of Donald Trump, and then extended it to Russiagate, and then extended it to COVID-19, and now they're doing it with Ukraine. So it's called disinformation. They're borrowing a term that Stalin more or less invented, disinformatia. He did this, used it the exact same way that they're using it now against their own populations, accusing anybody with an opinion that disagrees or is seen to, quote, undermine the policies of the government of the day, and just label it disinformation, or worse, extremism or conspiracy theory or whatever, under this banner of disinformation. It's a gravy train. It's a jobs worth program. And it's a very insecure government doing it, okay? Governments wouldn't have to do this if they had policies that actually made sense, were practical, and within budget constraints, etc., and weren't just wildly destructive, like what we saw during the so-called pandemic, the fake pandemic. The contrived, conjured pandemic. Unbelievable. And they want to counter harmful narratives from purported experts. Purported experts. They're talking about academics, doctors, epidemiologists who happen to disagree with the party line, who happen to disagree with Joseph Stalin's central party office diktats. I'm just turning the clock back, and they're guilty of disinformatia. Well, I'm just turning the clock back, folks. I'm just comparing Stalin's Russia and what I'm reading here, and it's a perfect overlay. Is the irony not lost on these people, these leaders? Unbelievable. It really is beyond the pale, caught with their pants down on this. What a waste of money. And worse than that, making members of the military more or less act unconstitutionally to target their own citizens for having opinions. And in this case, the correct opinions, because all these so-called sources of disinformation were right. They were all correct. And all the government experts were wrong. They were wrong. Every single last one of them, including the chief science advisor and the chief medical officer, including the Chuckle brothers, Valance and Witty, Twitty and Unbalanced. They were all wrong. Boris was wrong. Hancock was wrong. The Chuckle brothers were wrong. Dr. Hillary Jones was wrong. And it turns out now we can see they're all shilling for the pharmaceutical industry. But they already had their marching orders from Washington, from the Pentagon. Oh, we know that as well, don't we? So, 'cause this was a military operation. Ergo, this is a military unit in charge of communications and public relations, effectively. The 77th Brigade, i.e. It's a military operation. Again, we've been talking about this. Freddie Ponton has explained this very well, as we have on this program and other programs. So that's where we are, ladies and gentlemen. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it wonderful? Incredible. Absolutely incredible. David Davis goes on, and he said in March 2020, he began, well, who began work? The Mail published a statement. Ah, here we go. Listen to this, and we'll break in a second. The Mail published a statement from a member of the 77th Brigade whose name was not used to explain his role. Ooh, we're getting warmer. He said that in March 2020, right before the lockdowns, he began to work, or after the lockdowns, I'm not sure, they didn't specify when in March, he began to work with the 77th Brigade on the basis I would be helping root out foreign state misinformation on social media, i.e. Russian bots. Well, we already debunked that, didn't we? Doesn't exist. And he goes on, he says, but we would take screenshots of tweets from people expressing dissatisfaction with UK government's actions against COVID. Oh. He wrote saying that these were forwarded to the British Cabinet Office, to the Ministry of Truth. To skirt the legal difficulties of a military unit monitoring domestic dissent, we're quoting here, the view was that unless a profile explicitly stated their real name and nationality, they could be a foreign agent and were fair game. The irony of this, folks, is that the 77th Brigade were running sock puppet accounts. They still do. They still do. They don't display their real name or their nationality or anything. The double standards here. So they're out accusing everybody of being a foreign Russian bot because they're accounts that don't display their real name and nationality, but 77th Brigade doesn't display their real name or nationality or nothing credible because they're sock puppet accounts. Is the irony not lost on these people? Why would you want to be involved in a shameful escapade like this? What are you doing? What on earth are you doing? Stop and think about it, folks. Stop and think about it. Let's take a break here with TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. And we'll be right back with Arno Davile on the other side. Looking forward to this conversation. Stay right there.
Politically Incorrect on TNT Radio.
The desire to start putting mRNA componentry into veterinary products, I know what it's doing to the human population. Could we not presume that may well happen with the animal population? And why wouldn't the animal rights people be jumping up and down about such an intrusion into the bodies of animals? I would have thought they would have been leaping off tall buildings.
There had been a very active debate for 3 decades about whether or not we should consume genetically modified crops. And Europe was actually the bastion where that debate was really won on behalf of the citizens, that said, actually, guys, if you're going to put this in our food, please put a label, a mandatory label on the food, and then people can make a choice. And so when industry was forced to do that in Europe, there wasn't a single bit of GMO food that ended up in the human food supply. On the other hand, they had a very similar law for animal feed, but 85% of the compounded animal feed in Europe has, you know, for years been GMO. So what does that tell you? It tells you if you can read, you don't want the stuff. And it turns out animals can't read any of the languages we use, and they end up eating it.
Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on Today's News Talk, TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back to the live broadcast. We're in the second hour right now with TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Thank you for rejoining us and continue our deep dive into the issue of Ukraine. And joining us to help sort of understand this a little better and clarify this, the situation as it really stands, is independent journalist and human rights lawyer, international lawyer, Arno Devole, who has also been on the ground in Donbass recently, in recent months, on a fact-finding mission as an observer as well. And he's been on the program previously, and I think we have him on the line right now. Hello, Arno.
Good evening, Patrick. Nice to be with you.
It's great to be with you too, Arno. And I'll repeat what I said in the first hour because I want to set the scene here. A lot of people who are watching this situation right now are realizing, because of the politics in the U.S. and what's going on in Europe right now in the winter and what's happening in Ukraine and Russia, that things are coming to a head. Things are moving to a climax, or at least a sort of a climax. Is that, whether that's going to be a good thing or a bad thing remains to be seen. We're not sure exactly what's coming, but a lot of people, you maybe can correct me or agree, but a lot of people feel like something is going to happen. The question is, what's going to happen? What is your assessment of the situation right now?
Well, I guess this is the $64,000 proverbial question, dollar question. What we know as of this moment is that everybody in the Western NATO alliance seems to be bumbling onto each other in trying to beat each other to the post in sending yet more heavy weaponry, including armored vehicle, tanks. To be sure, not in proportions likely to influx or influence, I would say, the outcome of the conflict. We're talking about altogether between the Leopards, which are German-made but have been licensed out to Poland, for instance, and the Leclerc, French Leclerc, and the Challenger from the UK, even if you add the Abrams into the mix, so we're talking about between 200 and 300 tanks. Keep in mind that the Russian Federation is estimated to have between 12,000 and 15,000 tanks. So this is, you know, to provide some perspective to our listeners. Second of all, of course, the Russian general staff is perfectly aware of those developments, and contingency plans are being made at this moment to make sure that those vehicles never even make it to the front lines. We may be witnessing, you know, the blowing up of bridges to the Dnieper, so that, you know, those equipment never make it there. But it's in between the lines. First and foremost, this notion that NATO countries do not seem to realize what's going on. We can, in that respect, cite the now former defense minister from Germany, Miss Annabella Baerbock, who completely, in a completely deaf tone fashion, basically uttered in the confine of the European Parliament that Germany was at war with Russia, which would seem completely outlandish on its face, but this is actually what she explicitly stated. And so, you know, we're dealing with a bunch of leaders in the West who are not cognizant of the legal consequences and impact of their statements. We seem to be somehow sleepwalking into escalation. And we can only hope that the Russian leadership, you know, understands what kind of individuals they are dealing with and factor that in trying to refrain from reacting proportionally, you know, which would then, you know, probably lead to, you know, something that's some more cynical and I would say hell-bent for chaos forces in the West are banking on, which is a outright war on the European continent. So we're kind of walking on eggs right now, and it's really kind of surreal, to be honest. I was privileged a couple of weeks ago to give a briefing at the UN Security Council on this precisely this issue of escalation, and I was lamenting in my brief how much diplomacy has seemingly disappeared from the equation, and no one's talking to each other. And if anything, as a reaction to, I wasn't the only briefer, obviously, but at the close of the presentation, the usual suspects, you know, i.e. US, UK, and France, were all coordinating on parroting essentially the same line, which was that Russia was trying to divert from their own misdeed, i.e. the, you know, quote-unquote aggression, you know, of Ukraine. So completely ignoring the context, you know, going back to 2014, going back to the Minsk Agreement, Resolution 2202, and all of the implication that basically led to Russia taking matters into its own hand as Annex 2 to the resolution called for, to the extent a peaceful resolution to the conflict was not to be contemplated. So this is where we are right now. We're, this is at the same time a very dangerous time, and we're hoping that you know, everybody refrains from overreacting and harshly reacting to provocations, which, you know, sure enough seems to be the leitmotiv these days. I don't know, it's kind of a runaway train. We're just kind of stranded on it, and we just are waiting with bated breath. You know, it's a day-to-day experience, and I guess the main question is, everyone is wondering, you know, who's going to bring some sense of sanity in this whole thing.
This is interesting, Arno, and I want to ask you about the your experience with the ARIA format there in the UN. I've recognized this really looking at how the issue of Syria was being, you know, handled at the UN level. And the thing that strikes me, and also having seen and met Vitaly Churkin before he sadly passed away at a UN event in New York, but the Russian diplomatic team is very stable. The long-term positions, the U.S. and Britain seem to rotate. It's like a rotating chair. There's new people coming in all the time, and it seems like they're completely preoccupied with giving a unified message. So, as you said, reading the script. And so is this a case, and I noticed the comment, you might be able to comment on this, that the Russian commentary on the diplomatic situation or statements made by their Western counterparts has become very cynical. It's almost like they don't take them seriously, or they sort of acknowledge that they're just blowing hot air, and it's continuous, and it's become almost like it's not funny. It's not a comedy, but in a kind of a vaudeville tragedy. Russia used to play very straight down the line diplomatically. They didn't engage in any, not too much cynicism, very straight, very right down the line. Now it's almost as if they've lost faith, and they're just on the verge of almost just saying it's ridiculous. Is this a good thing in a way, in terms of, the paper tiger aspect of all the Western bluster? Or could this potentially lead to a very dangerous, unforeseen situation?
I guess it's difficult to say. I mean, to be sure, were you to be sitting in the Russian permanent ambassador to the UN, Nebezia, and Dmitry Polyansky's shoes right now, the UN trying to educate over and over, systematically repeating, you know, and contributing, adding more facts, patterns, you know, and hoping for most reasonable minds to prevail in vain, would at some point lead to some signs of frustration. And to be sure, I recall the ambassador's reaction in the wake of the Albanian representative, you know, cynically or kind of ironically stating, you know, that we do not seem to have the same perception on reality, obviously, but it never goes above and beyond, you know, this kind of terse statement. You know, they have to somewhat, you know, keep a grip, you know, on themselves, and it's part of, you know, what they are expected to be doing. But to be sure, at the same time, when you know how, you know, the Russian Foreign Service is trained, yeah, it's a telltale sign that patience is wearing thin, to be sure. And, you know, we can only hope that this is not the harbinger of things to come, you know, as far as, you know, diplomacy is concerned. You know, obviously, at some point down the road, parties are going to have to sit down and work out the issues. The question is, you know, what will be the, you know, the tipping point, you know, where, you know, at some point some people, I mean, when you see like someone like Henry Kissinger, who's by all account, someone who's been around the block, you know, who commands a certain respect, you know, from usual Western, even warmongers in the West, and the way he was last spring, you know, dismissed for just having merely uttered, you know, the fact that, you know, we might be, it might behoove us to sit down and reconfigure the European security architecture. And, you know, all the hyenas just basically went out, you know, and just, you know, got their knives out for him. So, I don't know, in that context, you know, I mean, I would say it raises a lot of concerns that, you know, if Kissinger himself cannot actually get those guys, you know, and I mean, we're talking about the Council on Foreign Relations, we're talking about, you know, basically the permanent establishment. If he cannot command some kind of, you know, respect whenever he says something, you know, in as far as the current situation is concerned, then who might be able to get it done? That's, to me, the main question right now.
That's a very important point. There always has to be some diplomats out there, some people of standing that can either weigh in publicly that might influence politicians, policymakers, etc. And that usually that's available, whether that's Henry Kissinger, whether that's Jimmy Carter. There's a host of other people that could fall into that category as well internationally. And it's a very difficult situation right now. What on that subject to Henry Kissinger, Arno, he made a statement at the World Economic Forum in Davos a couple of weeks ago that shocked a few people. He flip-flopped on, reversed his previous position, which was, as you pointed out, last year he said that he does not think it's a good idea for Ukraine to be a member of NATO. That was last spring, right when the conflict sort of started. And then he more or less reversed that in his statement to Davos this year. He said that things have moved on and progressed to the point where my previous statement is no longer practical, he said, or he alluded to something basically to that, basically reversing this idea. So opening the door that somehow it could be beneficial that Ukraine becomes a member of NATO to protect it from Russian aggression or something like this. What do you make of that Ukraine becomes a member of NATO to protect it from Russian aggression or something like this? What do you make of that policy, that statement reversal?
Well, I mean, if we adopt a somewhat objective approach to the situation as it stands right now, actually find this reversal worrying, because if anything, the factual trend, the fact pattern that existed back in April and which prompted him to make that statement would appear to be reinforced and accentuated today in a way that, you know, any reversal in his perception of the situation would only to me appear as if he's trying to somewhat get on the bandwagon of, I guess, younger representative of this permanent establishment. And I don't know, maybe he doesn't want to rock the boat, or maybe this is the consensus pressure, you know, this unstated, you know, echo chamber, and he's falling victim to it. But on his face, I do not take that reversal on his approach to the situation, you know, in a very optimistic way. I think it's quite worrying.
Yeah, it is worrying. It is worrying. That's a big thing to do a reversal on. It definitely is. And but before we go to, we're going to go to break in a couple minutes. But in your opinion, Arno, what about the risk of escalation? And just your opinion on what are the risks of escalation now, and how far could things go, practically speaking? Could it go potentially? Is there a serious risk of a nuclear exchange, or even threats getting to that point of threats and a standoff? What do you think the possibility of that is? Because there's a lot of people talking about this now in high political circles in the U.S. and Britain and in Europe, and it's a bit concerning that it's being spoken about almost in a kind of strategic way. It's similar to the Cold War, but a little bit more, let's say, aggressive. What are your thoughts on that risk, that issue?
Well, I guess there's several level of analysis as to your question. The first one is, let's look at the personnel. Back in the classical Cold War, we had, you know, more like what in the U.S. would be referred as paleoconservative, you know, or what this infamously remembered Bush administration official told Ron Suskin back in 2004, you know, you are from the reality-based community, and we forge our own reality now, and you will be left to basically study what we do. And just as you proceed on doing so, we'll move yet one step further and forge it again. You know, now we're dealing with people who are completely unhinged. Let's call it what it is. And obviously, I'm referring to the neocon crowd. They've dodged a bullet in the wake of Iraq, and this has had the effect of reinforcing their influence. I mean, they are now basically freely moving between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, you know, depending on the need of the day. But they are the permanent, you know, they control the entire establishment at the State Department, and they've had their offices in the Pentagon, and they're completely fusioned into the foreign policy decision-making process, and they have, you know, they have the ball right now. And I guess the second level of analysis is, are we merely talking about geostrategic issues, which would bear on, you know, taking into account, you know, the forces in presence and coming to some kind of consensus along the lines of what we've seen in Korea in 1953? I don't think so. I think we're dealing with something a lot more sinister here, which has to do with the entire U.S. political class having a lot of interest vested in the Ukraine theater. And so now it becomes a kind of a clan versus clan situation, a kind of a mobster, you know, component to it. You know, you don't steal from the mob or else, you know. And were there to be allowing what they've been scheming into Ukraine for the last 8 years to be taken away from them, one might think that this would be perceived as a sign of weakness, and they can't afford to be perceived as being gamed out by the Russians, as it were. So that's my second level. But the third level has to do with the concept of existential threat to one's own security and or existence. The Russian Federation is now mulling, revising their posture and as far as strategic weapons are concerned, where up to now the posture bears on existential threat, I guess, i.e. physical integrity. There are talks now that, and it's coming from Shoigu at the Ministry of Defense, that they will actually look into expanding, the range of uses which would lead to the use of strategic weapons. So this would tend to basically reveal that in Moscow they are realizing that slowly but surely it's dawning on them that they are not dealing with your run-of-the-mill or your run-of-the-road conventional geopolitical crisis here. They are dealing with people on the other side that are bent on going the full Monty, no matter what the cost. And I would say the fourth level of analysis is basically that the U.S. economy and its Western vassals is in ruin. I mean, this old debt-based economy system based on services has run its course. And I guess they are going back to the old playbook, which is, in as far as Washington, D.C. is concerned, which is to basically pull Europe, by the wayside and, hope for that things somewhat, work out to their advantage and then stand in line for a reconstruction contract. The problem here, we're not dealing with a third-rate military. We're dealing with, a superpower, nuclear superpower. One might say, these days, maybe, the preeminent conventional military, in the planet. And they are themselves, fully committed to preserve what they understand is their neo-abroad, re-establishing their neo-abroad so as to preserve their physical integrity. Events such as the one that took place last spring in, I think it was in the Baltic country nearby, bearing on Russian colonialism and this idea of, we're going to, denounce Russian colonialism on its minorities and, pushing for the breakup of the country into 22 ethnically conceived states, does not help matters any. So, I think all those factors put together, are pretty much, painting a pretty, ominous picture, to be sure.
No, without a doubt, without a doubt. And I had a question about NATO and what role NATO is going to have as a political organization. But we're going to go to break in a minute. I don't know. Can you stay with us for a few minutes after the break, Arno?
Sure, of course.
Okay, fantastic, fantastic, because I think this is a really important discussion we're into right now. You're listening to TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm on the line here with Arno Davalet, international lawyer, human rights lawyer, and we're breaking down some really important deep dive analysis on Ukraine. So stick around. We'll be right back after these messages.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Don't miss the forest for the trees. The real story today isn't whether Alec Baldwin's Spanish wife, Elaria, is actually from Spain. Of course she isn't. She's Hillary Lynn Hardway Thomas from Weston, Massachusetts. She's as American as Alec is. And the real story of the day isn't whether Damar Hamlin was really at the Bills game. It was probably a body double. Maybe it wasn't. Who knows? Who cares? The real story of the day isn't even that Mike Pence rushed to Joe Biden's rescue in the document scandal by conveniently finding some classified documents in his own house. Funny that he didn't rush to President Trump's defense, finding documents in his own house. No, the real story of the day is the absolute clown world that we're told to believe in, that anybody with half an ounce of common sense knows is completely false. But that's the Democrat Party today. Up is down, left is right, and right is wrong. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded.
So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. We're in the final stretch of the second hour here on the program. Thank you for rejoining us. And we're joined on the line by a great analyst, international lawyer, human rights lawyer, Arnaud Devallet. And he's recently been on the ground in Donbass in the recent months on a fact-finding mission and as an observer, and has had a good look at the conflict from the inside, but also, more importantly now in this discussion, from the outside. And I wanted to pose this question to you, Arnaud, because I think this is something that's it's become a problem that wasn't so much of a problem before, but is increasingly so today. And that if you listen to Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, it's more political speech. It's becoming a political organization. He's making political statements. He's referring to NATO territory. You probably noticed this as well on multiple occasions. So speaking of NATO as if it were some kind of a supranational political entity rather than a treaty. So if we think about the dangers of entangling alliances, as history has taught us with World War I and so forth, this is only making it more complicated. So what are your thoughts on NATO's role in this, and is NATO going to become an obstacle to peace if there is any chance for a ceasefire or peace negotiations?
Well, I think it's the meat of the question is pretty much NATO's existence and raison d'être in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. If you recall, basically the idea was back in 1990-91, and this was recently alluded to again by the French former foreign minister under François Mitterrand. He was foreign minister for about 10 years, including the post-Soviet Union collapse era, and the negotiation and the talks that were at the time held between Gorbachev and the Shevardnadze and Hans Dietrich Genscher, and you know, people obviously a lot more qualified, you know, and a lot more pondered than the slew of individuals that we are being treated to these days. And he basically said that you know, the whole idea, for instance, bearing on German reunification, was that NATO would not expand to the east. There would be there was actually a key issue which bore on the fact that World War II had ended without a treaty. And so it was important to somehow take into consideration in thus far as setting up the stage for a new era about the security needs of everyone involved. And if this involved the collapse of the Warsaw Pact, the idea was to demilitarize the member states of the Warsaw Pact and also the former republic, including the Baltic republics. And so this somewhat was the so people say, well, it was never in writing. Yeah, it's not in writing. But then again, you can look at it a couple of ways. You can look at it as what we call in contract law the Farrington four corner approach, you know, what's inside the four corner. Or you can adopt what's called the Corbyn totality of circumstances approach. And if you adopt the Corbyn approach, then you'll find out that the circumstances and the intent of the parties was pretty unambiguous, which was basically that representations were made and speeches were uttered, including by James Baker III at the time. And they were all in agreement that basically successor state, i.e. Russia, to the Soviet Union, were to be basically respected in as far as their security concern, and that included most centrally the fact that in exchange for allowing Germany to be reunited, NATO would have to basically remain where it were and not expand eastward. We all know now that this is not what happened, and that by 1997, this was the first, there were three waves of expansion. And by 1997, under Bill Clinton, basically, the promises or the agreement in principle was violated. And this is basically where we got slowly but surely where we are today. Because Russia never understood why Ukraine, for instance, would not preserve its neutral status. This was the red line for Russia was that Ukraine was to remain a neutral country, nor join NATO, and especially not, gain nuclear weapons on its soil. All those red lines have been obviously violated, and this is basically where we are now. The situation has come to a head, and Russia has had to not only exercise its obligation, its duties under the annex two of the resolution 2202, i.e. the UN version of the Minsk Accord, but also I would say act proactively to preserve its own territorial integrity, because the two countries being so intrinsically linked, if one goes down, the other one is obviously fundamentally and adversely affected. So this is where we are, and NATO has always been an institution on what's called a mission creep institution. As early as 1992, they revised their official posture. They became this kind of military arm of the UN, and they're kind of being used as a Swiss knife in all kind of operations, starting in Somalia in 1992. And reaching a crescendo with this now Asian version of NATO that's being contemplated. So NATO is not just the North Atlantic Defense Organization, it's actually a global organization which aims to basically force a fusion of the corporate interest in all the areas, regional areas, where those interests are likely to be developed and or reinforced and or imposed by whatever means necessary.
And this is the sort of frustrating part of the conversation, Arno, and I'm sure from an international relations scholarship point of view, which it seems like it used to be valued a little bit more. If you take, let's say, the John Mearsheimer realist school approach, you'd probably be doing what you just said, what you laid out, take into account the totality of the circumstances of what's involved in order to make a value judgment on what is the most prudent or pragmatic or useful move that all parties can make and come to some kind of an agreement on, some sort of middle ground, as it were. But here I see the US and the UK punditry, the Euro punditry as well. They lean heavily on these two talking points with NATO. They keep repeating, I'm hearing this more and more, that NATO is a defensive alliance. It's not an offensive alliance, okay. Then they say it's a voluntary organization. No, we don't force anybody to join NATO. They join on their own accord. And those lines are repeated almost automatically in all parts of this conversation when you hear it from the punditry on the NATO side of the argument in different countries. And so almost like it's very hard to... It's hard for a lot of mainstream journalists to overcome this, because this is what the quote experts are saying. So it's a bit of a stalemate. They're really sticking to that line, Arno, and it's almost like they don't want to get into the whole geopolitical analysis, the realist analysis, the Mearsheimer analysis of it. What are your thoughts on this problem?
Well, that's actually a very good point. This has to do with the terms of reference. I mean, obviously, if you get two parties sitting across each other at a table and they're not perceiving what would appear to be an objective set of facts the same way. One is seeing it in a blue fashion, the other one is seeing it obviously in a red fashion. How can you hope to proceed in a dialectical fashion into some kind of, you know, modus vivendi? Here we're talking about people who seem to have made up their own lingo. We went from the UN Charter to the rule-based order. This is actually also what we've been hearing the last couple of years, 3 years now. And to the point of what you were saying, yes, I mean, sure, everybody is on its face entitled to join NATO, but it's almost like that that Article 2, Paragraph 9 line of the UN Charter, which is, you know, in, you know, you have to take into account, you know, people being able to enjoy peace and live, you know, preserved from aggression, but at the same time you have to respect the sovereignty of countries. And so when you allow anyone to basically do whatever they want, i.e. join NATO, without taking into account the fact that they may be living next to a country which is decidedly not slated to be joining NATO. Why? Because NATO needs, you know, a boogeyman to justify its own existence. Then you open up a whole new can of worms. And this is, again, you know, and more precisely to the point, the quandary in which we find ourselves. As if NATO was kind of living in its own bubble with its own echo chamber, its own elements of language, and not taking into account the fact that there's a whole new bloc emerging out there which does not want to hear anything about NATO and or neoliberal policies, as a matter of fact. I would add to that that in the spars, this obsession on Russia, and this is another good point, I mean, we can see this hysteria, this Russophobia. I mean, it bears noting that if you were to replace the word Russian with, you know, let's say Jewish, you know, you would, and justifiably so, you know, get outraged by what's being peddled these days. As a means to illustrate my point, and you have, you know, they're going after the, you know, the deads now, because there's this Russian cemetery in the suburbs of Paris. It's been there since 1927, and obviously in the wake of the sanctions, you know, bearing on wire transfer, it is becoming impossible now to attend to the tombs, you know, and keep, you know, the cemetery, you know, kept properly. And so we find ourselves now, you know, with, you know, confronted with increasingly surreal situation. And it's, I guess it's par for the course with this whole cancel culture thing. But it sounds pretty scary, if you ask me. And you add to that, you know, the psychological and maybe some would say historical, family historical baggage that some individual that the U.S. State Department seem to carry on. And which has, to me, a certain influence, certain impact on how they perceive, you know, policy vis-a-vis Russia. I'm talking essentially about people like Victoria Nuland and Robert Kagan and people like that. You know, there was an interesting presentation made a few months back by Gonzalo Lira. I would highly recommend our listeners to check it out. It's about an hour and 34 minutes. And he basically brushes a portrait of Victoria Nuland and her ilk. We're dealing with people who have score to settle, and this goes way back. And they may not themselves be conscious of, you know, what motivates them, but it is pregnant in how they make, you know, policymaking is formulated. And so basically we're all being taken hostage, you know, on the train, you know, which is driven by people who whose own family histories basically dictates and conditions how they you know, formulate policy against, I mean, vis-a-vis Russia. And that's what I think is a very preoccupying component or dimension to the current situation.
And I would add Chrystia Freeland, second in command in Canada, to that list.
Yes.
next to Miss Newland. That's a bit of a problem. Yes, indeed. And I'll also add to what you said, the Auschwitz Memorial Committee disinviting Russia to visiting Auschwitz on the anniversary. I mean, that's just unbelievable.
Eternal shame.
Yeah, I mean, it's the irony of it is just beyond the pale, you know, the Soviet.
Well, Russia being disinvited and Ukraine being invited, when we know that Ukraine obviously went above and beyond the call of duty, quote unquote, in what happened 80 years ago, as far as the mass slaughter of the Jewish people in Europe, yes.
Mm. Yeah, the Benderites, the Poles. Uh-huh. The Jews, the camps, the pogroms, unbelievable. The Ukrainian SS divisions. You honestly couldn't make it up, Arno. You really couldn't. But we appreciate your analysis on this and your input. It's been absolutely invaluable. Arno Devole, thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you, Patrick.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That's Arno Devole, international lawyer. And a big thanks to Finian Cunningham, veteran journalist, in the first hour. I think we got through a lot there, but there's more to come. There's more to come this week. So stay tuned to TNT. Today's News Talk, I'm Patrick Henningsen. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay on the network right now for the Jesse Zurawell Show, coming up after the top of the hour news headlines. Take care, folks.